Today is Tuesday, September 22nd, and this is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the 75th UN General Assembly begins.
Today we have a surplus of multilateral challenges and a deficit of multilateral solutions.
Also ahead, a doctor describes fighting COVID-19 in remote Brazilian villages. Plus, Australian scientists and volunteers rescue dozens of whales. These stories and more are next. Our top story is at the United Nations in New York, where on Tuesday, world's leaders begin giving their presentations to the annual General Assembly. On Monday, the UN marked the 75th anniversary of its founding amid a global pandemic and other serious challenges that the UN Secretary General said highlights the urgency for stronger international cooperation. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir has more.
It was June 1945 in San Francisco, California, that the UN Charter was signed. Created to prevent a repeat of the atrocities of World War II, the United Nations has offered a framework to peacefully resolve international disputes. The organization marks its 75th anniversary in a world confronting a different set of challenges, said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Monday.
And the COVID-19 pandemic has laid bare the world's fragilities. We can only address them together. Today we have a surplus of multilateral challenges and a deficit of multilateral solutions.
Confirmed coronavirus cases worldwide have surpassed 31 million, with more than 960,000 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which tracks the data. Guterres noted UN accomplishments like reducing hunger and poverty, eradicating diseases, and assisting millions of victims of conflict and disaster. And he pointed to daunting challenges ahead.
Climate calamity looms. Biodiversity is collapsing. Poverty is again rising. Hatred is spreading. Geopolitical tensions are escalating.
The anniversary commemoration kicked off the UN General Assembly, an annual meeting of world leaders. But because of the pandemic, most of the gatherings this year are virtual, with leaders sending video messages. Only one representative from each country is allowed inside the UN hall. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, New York.
The first speaker on Tuesday is Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro, followed by U.S. President Donald Trump, Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and China's Xi Jinping. Secretary General Guterres warned against a, quote, new Cold War, end quote.
The world needs a global ceasefire to stop all hot conflicts. But at the same time, we must do everything to avoid a new Cold War. We are moving in a very dangerous direction. Our world cannot afford a future where the two largest economies split the globe in a great fracture, each with its own trade and financial rules and internet and artificial intelligence capacities. A technological and economic divide risks inevitably turning into a geostrategic and military divide, and we must avoid this at all costs.
In his speech, U.S. President Trump criticized China over its response to the coronavirus.
In the earliest days of the virus, China locked down travel domestically while allowing flights to leave China and infect the world. China condemned my travel ban on their country, even as they canceled domestic flights and locked citizens in their homes. The United Nations must hold China accountable for their actions.
The United States has the largest COVID-19 outbreak in the world, with over 6.8 million cases and nearly 200,000 deaths. China's Jinping said he had no intention to fight, quote, a cold war or hot one, end quote, with any country. He said China, quote, resolutely rejects the baseless accusations against China, end quote. Also speaking today are South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, Russian President Vladimir Putin, Iran's Hassan Rouhani, and Emmanuel Macron of France. In Geneva, a World Health Organization alliance announced late Monday that 156 countries have joined the global COVAX scheme intended to ensure fair distribution of supplies of future vaccines against COVID-19. The goal of COVAX is by the end of 2021 to deliver 2 billion vaccine doses around the world. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said healthcare workers will be prioritized initially, followed by the most vulnerable 20% of people in every participating country.
Some daunting challenges. For the ACT Accelerator to work as planned, it must be funded. So far, $3 billion has been invested. This has resulted in a very successful startup phase, but it's only a tenth of the remaining $35 billion needed for scale-up and impact.
While many lower-income nations are seeking assistance via COVAX, some richer countries have been slow to confirm their intentions. The United States, Russia, and China do not plan to join COVAX. Head of the Gavi Vaccines Alliance, Seth Berkley.
As of today, 64 higher-income countries, including 29 economies operating as Team Europe, have submitted legally binding commitments to join the COVAX facility. We expect as many as 38 more countries to join in the coming days, many of whom have already publicly stated their intent to do so.
Since the announcement, the list of COVAX participants has grown as Mexico's foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard, said Tuesday his country will finalize a deal to join the alliance. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will announce new restrictions on social interaction Tuesday as the government tries to slow the spread of the coronavirus before it spirals out of control. In Spain, new partial lockdown measures became effective on Monday in Madrid's working-class district of Vallecas, the morning after residents took to the streets to call for better healthcare provisions, complaining of discrimination by the authorities. Reuters' Olivia Chan reports.
New partial lockdown measures started on Monday in Madrid as the country battles another surge of coronavirus cases. The new rules predominantly apply to areas of lower income and with higher immigrant populations. In Vallecas, Madrid's southern working-class district, police set up checkpoints to enforce the new measures. The area has one of the highest infection rates in the capital, but some residents are not pleased by the localized lockdowns.
Horrorosas y fatales, porque no sé por qué no discrimina.
They say it discriminates against the poor. Dozens staged protests outside the regional government headquarters as Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez met with Madrid's regional leader on Monday. Authorities in Spain's capital, which accounts for a third of all infections in the country, announced the restrictions in areas where levels exceed 1,000 per 100,000 inhabitants. In those areas, access to parks and public areas will be restricted. Gatherings will be limited to 6 people, and commercial establishments will have to close by 10 p.m. Spain has recorded more than 640,000 COVID-19 cases, the highest number in Western Europe. The disease has killed more than 30,000. The Spanish economy slumped 18.5% in the second quarter. The country is receiving $166 billion in grants and loans from the EU's coronavirus recovery program.
Thanks to Olivia Chan of Reuters for that report. COVID-19's global spread has reached across the globe, including to Brazil's remote indigenous communities. But responding to the pandemic there is not easy. For more, I spoke to Dr. Monica Dons with the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF. Dons has been responding to COVID-19 outbreaks in native communities in Brazil's Mato Grosso do Sul region.
All 11 of the communities that we have been in have had cases. Overall, the numbers of cases are going down in this area. So the peak was, you know, around the beginning of August. Then there was a little bit of a plateau, and now the cases have decreased. Some of them are still active cases, which are currently in isolation. There are some people that are still in the hospital, and then there have been quite a few deaths from the population overall. So the community has tried to protect themselves by isolating themselves. They've tried very hard to not permit any outsiders in, but also them not to go out. And because of that, they've not been able to buy or sell things as they normally would in town. And then also, since they live so close together, if one person in the house does have COVID, everyone else in the house is considered a close contact. And that is very difficult to have everyone isolated. Having people isolated is not really something that they're used to as a community. And so if you have a whole household isolated, the rest of the community wants to help that house that's isolated. And so minimizing contact with outsiders has been particularly challenging.
Besides the COVID-19 cases themselves, how else has the pandemic impacted these communities?
One of the unanimous requests we had when we met with them in the beginning to ask how we could support was support with mental health. And most of this was anxiety related to maybe some misinformation about COVID. I think all over the world, there's been a lot of information about COVID, and it's hard to tease out what is actually true or not if you're a lay person. And then also just the impact of losing large amounts of people relative to their population. Ability to perform traditional rituals. And then also a lot of anxiety about being in isolation when your entire existence has been living in a true community. It's not normal or natural to be isolated from other people in your community.
And how has the healthcare system in Brazil been doing responding to the needs of these indigenous communities?
Locally, there were a lot of people who were sick. And so the mobile teams that were responsible for providing healthcare and doing contact tracing and monitoring in these areas, they didn't have the human resources available to care for all of these populations. The total population is actually only 8,000, but they're scattered. And when you only have one doctor and one nurse because the rest of your team is sick, it was very difficult for the system that was already in existence to support large numbers of people who were falling ill. And so we came into support with human resources in terms of more doctors and nurses, but then also with some additional resources like water sanitation, health promotion, and mental health, because those were other gaps that we identified.
Now, how do you make sure that your teams don't bring the virus to these remote villages?
So amongst our own team, we have specific ways that we live so that we can minimize the chance of spreading to each other. We live in a place where we each have our own room and our own bathroom. We also have strict rules about social distancing and mask use amongst ourselves. And then we also have a system to make sure that if there is a case amongst ourselves, which there has not been, we can act accordingly. So basically, we do all of the preventive measures amongst ourselves. And then when we enter the community, we're always wearing a mask. I mean, all of the time we're wearing masks. And then when we work in the primary healthcare clinic or are doing home visits, we wear PPE. And we have a system for changing our PPE in between each home visit.
Last of all, what has MSF learned from its work in these communities?
As MSF, we've changed, at least in Brazil, and gone from focusing on ICU-level care only and hospital care to focusing more on the community aspect of prevention and realizing that you can have maybe even a bigger impact with less resources if you act earlier. Because we know that even in the best of circumstances, by the time someone gets to the ICU, their chance of survival is quite low, especially for intubated patients. So what we've shifted towards is focusing on the very, very beginning, and that's capacitation of community healthcare workers to make sure that there's preventive mechanisms in place so people know what COVID is in the community and they're able to prevent the transmission. And once cases are identified, that the community health workers are empowered to be able to act.
That was Dr. Monica Dons from the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders in Brazil. This is VOA. An arms depot of the Iran-backed Shiite Muslim group Hezbollah exploded in southern Lebanon Tuesday, a security source told Reuters. Several people were injured. There was no immediate statement from Hezbollah, but the security source said the blast in the arms depot was due to a, quote, technical error, end quote. The blast sent a huge column of black smoke into the sky from the village of Ain Kana in the south of the country, a political stronghold of Hezbollah. The explosion stirs new worries in Lebanon, a country still reeling from a devastating explosion at a Beirut port last month that killed at least 190 people. U.S. authorities have charged a New York police officer with espionage, accusing him of gathering information about the city's Tibetan community for the Chinese government. AFP reports the indictment released Monday says the officer, who worked at a station in the Queens section of the city, received directions from members of the Chinese consulate in New York. Born in China, the man had been granted political asylum in the U.S., claiming he was tortured by Chinese authorities because of his Tibetan ethnicity. But the 33-year-old is accused of spying on the Tibetan community's activities, as well as identifying potential information sources. The Chinese authorities allegedly paid him tens of thousands of dollars for his service. The officer has been charged with four counts, including enlisting in the service of a foreign country on U.S. soil. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. A tense political battle between Democrat and Republican lawmakers is shaping up in the U.S. over who will replace Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Ginsburg, a feminist icon, died last week from cancer at age 87. She was a staunch supporter of women's rights, including the right to access abortion. Democrats fear Trump will appoint a new justice who may rule against such rights.
Let's say I make the announcement on Saturday. There's a great deal of time before the election. That'll be up to Mitch in the Senate.
At the White House late Monday and later at two stops in Ohio, Trump said he plans to put forward his nomination to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg Friday or Saturday. But congressional Democrats like Minority Whip Dick Durbin are crying foul.
A nation guided by a rule of law cannot have one set of rules under Democratic presidents and another set under Republican presidents.
After the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, President Barack Obama's nomination of Judge Merrick Garland in March 2016 was not brought to a vote by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell because it was an election year. Mike Garcia, Washington.
For analysis of what the coming judicial appointments battle may mean for the U.S. Supreme Court, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to constitutional law professor Joel Richard Paul from the University of California, Hastings.
We already have a court that is highly polarized. Generally speaking, there are five conservative members of the court and four more liberal members of the court. She was considered by many people to be the most liberal or one of the most liberal people, or at least the leader of the liberal wing of the court. So losing her means that the liberal members of the court are that much weaker. And I think the most significant part of this is that we are in a moment in time in which there are a great many legal challenges pending in the courts concerning the upcoming election in the United States. There are legal cases that have been brought concerning qualifications to vote, concerning how people can vote, concerning the mail-in ballots and how they will be counted. And all of these cases are likely to get appealed up to the Supreme Court at some point. So there's a fairly good possibility that the Supreme Court may end up deciding the next election, either directly or indirectly. And the possibility that President Trump may appoint a third member of the court may be significant for that reason.
Having, you know, only eight justices on the court now, what would happen if the court was split 4-4 in one of these decisions? Does it go back down to whatever the lower court ruling stands then?
Right. So if you have a situation where no one is confirmed for the Supreme Court before these cases are heard, and the court splits 4-4 on traditional political lines, then the case as decided by the circuit court, the Court of Appeals, would stand. So the circuit court, whatever the circuit court decided in a particular case, would be the law of the land.
That was constitutional law professor Joel Richard Paul from the University of California, Hastings, speaking to International Edition's Steve Miller. In Australia, rescuers set free around 25 whales on Tuesday. The whales were marooned on a sandbar off the remote west coast of Tasmania. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Rescuers set free around 25 whales on Tuesday, marooned on a sandbar off Australia's island of Tasmania, with hopes to refloat hundreds more within days. But government scientists said about 90 of the 270 have died. The pod of pilot whales were first spotted in shallow water off the rugged coastline on Monday. Parks and Wildlife Regional Manager Nick Deeker.
We've rescued about 25 at the present time and escorted them out the channel and out to sea, and crews are continuing to work. So that number will increase before we get to the end of the day.
The rescue has been labour-intensive, physically pushing the animals or using specialised cloth and pontoons to drag them to deeper water. Pilot whales are a species of oceanic dolphin that grow to 7 metres long and weigh up to 3 tonnes. Around 40 scientists, 20 police officers, fish farmers and volunteers are involved in the rescue effort, the hardest experts say they have encountered yet.
Thanks to Libby Hogan of Reuters for that report. That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On September 11th, the United States, Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, Thailand, Vietnam, and the ASEAN Secretariat launched the Mekong-U.S. Partnership. This new partnership reflects the importance of the Mekong region to the United States and will expand on the cooperation begun in 2009 under the Lower Mekong Initiative. We will build on the good work of the Lower Mekong Initiative and the $3.5 billion in regional U.S. assistance during the last 11 years, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a statement. At the inaugural meeting of the Mekong-U.S. Partnership, the United States announced more than $150 million in assistance for the Mekong region. Of that total, $52 million is supporting COVID-19 recovery, $55 million will counter transnational crime, $33 million will help develop sustainable and secure energy markets, and $2 million will help fight human trafficking. The Mekong-U.S. Partnership is committed to the autonomy, economic independence, good governance, and sustainable growth of partner countries. We have supported economic growth with more than $1 billion to develop infrastructure in ASEAN countries through the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation and plan to invest billions more in the coming years, said Secretary Pompeo. He warned, however, about the need to confront the challenges at hand, including those from the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, which increasingly threatens the Mekong's natural environments and economic autonomy. The CCP's unilateral decisions to withhold water upstream have exacerbated a historic drought. The United States stands with the region and the Mekong River Commission in calling for transparent data sharing. We encourage countries of the Mekong region to hold the CCP accountable to its pledge to share its water data. That data should be public. It should be released year-round, declared Secretary Pompeo. And it should be shared through the Mekong River Commission, the organization that serves the interests of Mekong region countries, not those of Beijing. The United States is also concerned about infrastructure-linked debt and the predatory and opaque business practices of Beijing's state-owned actors, such as China Communications Construction Company. Another concern is the boom in trafficking of persons, drugs, and wildlife, much of which emanates from organizations, companies, and special economic zones linked to the CCP. Through the Mekong-U.S. partnership, the United States looks forward to defending the interests of its partner countries and collaborating to ensure a peaceful, secure, and prosperous Mekong region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.